Welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. My name is Trevor Harris. On this week's program, we focus on classical performance and composition. In our first segment, I talk with members of the Cypress String Quartet about the music that moves them and their new release that features a pair of quintets by the Austrian composer Franz Schubert. In our second segment, I visit with American composer Judith Zeymont. She'll be in Columbia this Saturday for the premiere of her new orchestral work, The River. That's coming up later on this week's Thinking Out Loud. Classical music ensemble Cypress String Quartet has a new release out, a pair of quintets by Austrian composer Franz Schubert. We'll visit with two members of the quartet after this, the third movement from Schubert's String Quintet in C major by the Cypress String Quartet featuring cellist Gary Hoffman. This is Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. That was the third movement of Franz Schubert's String Quintet in C major from the new release by the Cypress String Quartet featuring cellist Gary Hoffman. Over the past several years, we've shared with KBIA's classical music listeners tracks from multiple recordings by the Cypress String Quartet. Their recorded repertoire includes 14 CD releases, including compositions by American composer and 2010 Pulitzer Prize winner Jennifer Higdon, Beethoven's String Quartets, Dvorak's Cypresses, works by Claude Debussy, and now Franz Schubert gets the Cypress treatment. My name is Trevor Harris, and I recently talked by phone with cellist Jennifer Kletzel and violinist Tom Stone. They, together with violinist Cecily Ward and violinist Ethan Filner, make up the Cypress String Quartet. This spring, the quartet released their 14th CD. The new issue features a pair of quintets from Austrian Franz Schubert. They're joined by cellist Gary Hoffman for the recording. I asked the pair how they came to settle on the noted cellist Hoffman as the first soloist to join them for a recording. The first to respond was the Cypress String Quartet's Jennifer Kletzel.
I met Gary 24 years ago. He was a judge at a competition that I did in Italy. And I did not win the competition, but when I was removed from the final round, he was really generous with his time and comments to the people that didn't move on to that final round, and invited me to master classes in the south of France where he was teaching. I had a wonderful experience. He became sort of a mentor to me and then a good friend, and now it's been fun to have him as a colleague for the last number of years. So since, you know, the quartet formed 18 years ago, he already knew that we were forming then. We started playing the Schubert Quintet with other cellists for years, and kept coming back to, I really wanted to do it with him, because the very first Schubert Quintet I ever played was with Gary Hoffman at the Caramore Festival in New York. And so we finally made the time, and we live in San Francisco and he lives in Paris, so there's some
challenging
there are challenging logistics there. But we performed it with him a number of places and over a couple of seasons, and really forged a collective view and interpretation of the piece, and decided that we really wanted to record it with him. So this is a dream come true for me after that many years of, you know, somebody being in your life and being important to you.
I'm curious about the selection of the Schubert work for the piece. Reading in your liner notes that David Threacher penned, Schubert was 31 in 1828, and he was not having a good year.
No, not at all. In fact, that was the year he died. So, yeah, bad year.
He's very sick.
So how does that, I don't know if it was agony is the right word, but how does that suffering come through in the string quintet in C?
I think he rose above the suffering. I think that's how it comes into that. It's like, you know, we all have had an experience probably of knowing somebody who's been very, very ill, and they seem to just rise above it. And I think that Schubert did that in this piece. I mean, you think not only was he incredibly ill and uncomfortable and impoverished and didn't think that he would have any, you know, impact on the world or any stamp, because he couldn't even get his string music published. And it wasn't, you know, 25, 50 years later when people finally started recognizing what a genius he was. So I think it was hard on so many levels, and yet he persevered.
Yeah, it was really like an escape, I think, into the best part of his imagination. Mm-hmm. And it must have taken an incredible act of will on his part, you know, to leave so much of the pain and suffering behind and write such ideal music. You know, at the same time, like, you hear sadness and suffering in his music, but, you know, I can't tell you if that's the sadness and suffering that we all experience in life, or if it was particular to that year of Schubert's life. But, you know, but I think the music has lasted because he overcame that and found something really universal.
So he died 1828, age 31. And mm-hmm. then it took a couple generations and his stock rose.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Threacher also says in the liner notes to the new CD that in 1906, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, in declaring him a fountainhead of modern music. So this was almost 80 years after he had died. What happened in that period of time that caused Franz Schubert's stock to increase so much in value?
That's a good question.
I think people continued somehow. I mean, that you know, we don't know how much of his music didn't, you know, was lost, because actually when he died, he didn't have a home of his own. He was basically staying at different people's homes, and his belongings and therefore his scores and things were scattered. And so it's amazing that we have as much of his music as we do that you know, survived then 50 years, 80 years later. But I think people who had the music continued to work on it, to play it, and then just began to realize, wait, this is timeless.
Yeah, but, you know, before Schubert, music was very much of its time, and people were really just paying attention to music of their time. And it was composers like Brahms and Mendelssohn who encouraged society to look back to the past. Brahms had an incredible music library and is partially responsible, I think, for the quintet coming back into being published and coming back into performance. So, you know, it was later composers who really had great taste in mm-hmm. Brahms' case, you know, who are responsible for bringing him back. You know, I can't explain to you why some great artists are overlooked in their lifetime. We think of it as a tragedy, and that's one of the reasons why we commission as actively as we do, because we want to really find support and encourage the great artists living amongst us to write in their time and to leave a legacy for future generations. It's something that's very, very important to us.
That was Cypress String Quartet violinist Tom Stone. Here he is with the rest of the Cypress String Quartet and guest cellist Gary Hoffman on their recent release of Schubert Quintets. This is a selection from the finale of Schubert's Quintet in C Major from the Cypress String Quartet. You're listening to Thinking Out Loud on 91.3 FM KBIA. Thank you. Thanks for listening to KBIA. My name is Trevor Harris. I often announce weekday classical music here on KBIA. A request we get occasionally is to play more contemporary composers. Also, there's the occasional request to play more works written by female composers. On the second half of this week's Thinking Out Loud, we meet both those requests with a hearty yes. We're in the final week of the 2014 Hot Summer Nights Music Festival from the Missouri Symphony Society. This Saturday, July the 12th, Maestro Kirk Trevor leads the Missouri Symphony Orchestra at the Missouri Theater in a show that features works by Mendelssohn, Claude Debussy, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Judith Zamont. Zamont is a contemporary composer who will be in town for the Saturday premiere of her new work, The River. I recently spoke with Judith Zamont by phone from her home in Arizona. We discussed how nature inspires her work and how the creative process happens for her. You'll hear part of that conversation now and a sample of her work. Here's a segment from Zamont's orchestral tone poem Chroma, Northern Lights. The work is performed by the Slovak National Symphony Orchestra under the direction of, you guessed it, Maestro Kirk Trevor. You're listening to KBIA. That was a selection from Judith Zamont's Chroma, Northern Lights. The composer will be in our fair city of Columbia this weekend for the premiere of her new work, The River. I recently asked her how the natural world influences her compositions.
I do pay attention to not disasters, but evidences of Mother Nature at her raised attention level around the world. It's one of the things that interests me. I've lived in various climates throughout my, over the years, and always I'm paying attention to humidity, what's going on in the sky, what's outdoors. A lot of people think of themselves maybe as urban folks and then are largely indoor-oriented. Me, I've always wanted the outdoors.
Does the natural world play into your compositions and when you're writing new pieces?
Yes, in a couple of ways. One, there is a whole stream of pieces that I've written for various forces that celebrate the wonders of the natural world. I have two different sets of 12 preludes each for piano devoted to the individual months of the year. I'm the only composer in history that's done it twice. Fanny Mendelssohn-Hensel did it once. Tchaikovsky did it once. And a couple of other people in the 20th century now have done it once, but me, I've gone through it twice. I have a chamber piece that is exploring the essence of the auroras in both the northern and southern hemisphere. My piano concerto is devoted into is devoted to experiencing spaceflight, getting out and away from the Earth into the next frontier. My second piano trio, Zones, is about climate zones, cold, warm, and temperate. And I guess I'm like litmus paper, atmosphere and pressure differences, sun or no sun, they really affect me. I always think, you know, what would Kierkegaard have been writing if he lived in Hawaii? It's the nature of us that we respond to our environment.
Tell me about your process when you sit down to compose a new piece, or back up a step. How does a new piece come to you?
Oh, thank you for reminding me. That's the other way nature is so important to me. I often hear music in my head spontaneously as a counterpoint to my doing something else that could be considered a lower level activity, like walking or vacuuming or doing anything, exercise, doing anything that is over time and over some distance, where you may zone out from the activity itself, and then into your head comes music that's very different.
So you were out walking, or
yes,
or looking for seashells, or whatever you were doing, and this piece of music popped into your head. When you get back to your home or your office, what's the process like then of getting that out and getting that down on paper or on screen?
The hardest thing is to remember it accurately. I have a few baskets around my house in which I keep little bits of torn off paper from various pads, in which I've scribbled down something that reminds me of what the idea was. Usually it's very precise rhythmically, and it's got some kind of funny variant of solfege to indicate rise or fall of a motive or even part of a melody. But it's very important to get the character of the item down. Sometimes I do need to do a distracting activity in order to start the juices flowing. For instance, I have another orchestra piece that Maestro Trevor has actually recorded with an orchestra elsewhere, called Stillness. And that is a piece in which I had to make myself quiet, which is a very hard thing to do. I tried to write it while I was on holiday break, or started on holiday break from teaching at the University of Minnesota. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't make myself quiet enough. Finally, I had the opportunity through an Aaron Copland Award to go and live in Aaron Copland's house for 2 months, all by myself. That was part of the award. And there I finally got quiet enough to sketch the whole thing out and then begin the complete orchestration. But it takes some doing to unwind me. And that's why writing pieces that are on the large scales of nature phenomenon is something that's attractive to me, because it is so different from my normal small frame agitato kind of writing.
You mentioned the Copland Award, and you had the opportunity to stay and work in his house. Where is his house?
It's up along the, I don't know. I think it might be near the Hudson River. It's up in Creskill in New York. I know you're a geographer, so you know all these places.
I've been there. I haven't been there in Copeland's house, but I've been to the city of Hudson, New York, and I've been to some other places along the Hudson Valley.
Yes. actually, this is up on a little bit of a bluff somewhere, and it was quite wonderful. There were deer that would regularly come into the yard. I could look out the windows when I was having breakfast and just see them out there grazing and sauntering along. And that was a magical experience, to write at Copeland's desk, surrounded by a library of Copeland scores, which I regularly dipped into, and be invested with the sereneness of this place, both outside and inside the residence.
Did being there help you understand or appreciate his works more once you saw the place from whence they had sprung?
Well, the score that I pulled most to study was one of his very last orchestra pieces, Inscriptions, the one that he wrote for the inauguration of Lincoln Center that the New York Philharmonic gave. Many people thought that wasn't quintessential Copeland, the Copeland they knew from the ballets, but I looked at the orchestration very closely. There are portions of it that are pretty rigorous 12-tone writing, and yet it's Copeland all the way the layering works, how the high winds, where they are situated in the column of sound, how broad or how compressed that sound column is at times. It has definitely got Copeland's stamp from beginning to end. The man was himself always. There's a purity in it that I think of very much as Copeland.
My name is Trevor Harris. This is Thinking Out Loud. My guest this week is composer Judith Zamont. Judith will be in Columbia this weekend for the premiere of her new work. Judith, can you tell KBI listeners what they'll expect when they come out to hear the Missouri Symphony Orchestra with your premiere, and what's it called?
The piece is called The River, and it is the result of my contemplation of all the great rivers I've had the good fortune to live near in the course of my life. I grew up in New York, though born in Memphis, Tennessee, and we had, of course, the Hudson River, the East River. These are mature rivers, and at the tip of Long Island out there was the Atlantic Ocean. For a year, I lived in Paris in France. And the Seine, which winds its way through the center of the city, is a pretty quiet river, as is the Hudson when the banks get broad enough. For some 15 years, I lived in the Minneapolis area. And here we are in the upper reaches of the Mississippi. And that river, too, at that point, has broad banks. And the flow is pretty quiet. So my prototype for river was something that has this majesty about it. At my one other river experience I can think of is nothing like white water rafting. It was taking a boat trip down a portion of the Danube River. Now, after I moved to Arizona, about 8 years back, all of a sudden the climate was very different. There are no rivers in my town. As a matter of fact, we were a kind of landlocked, far suburb of Phoenix, and to get out of town, you drive over a roadway that is supposed to have the Gila River flowing under it. Well, in the 8 years I've lived here, I've never seen a drop of moisture in that culvert. Never. Not even when we get floods. So in the music itself is this mature river in which a current begins and the river flows in its direction and things may happen on the banks. No impediments cross that mighty stretch and it moves to its close at the end. It's sort of like a boat trip down the Danube, you might say.
So at a root level, why do rivers appeal to you? What is it about those rivers? You mentioned the rivers that you saw growing up, and now the absence of a river, and you feel that absence. What is it about those bodies of water that speaks to you?
we need water. Water is an essential natural resource. Life cannot be without water. Water was also an important part of my family's concern as a child. Our family major concern was enhancement of water quality and access to potable water in wherever you lived. And it was my father's life work to be concerned with this, and that naturally devolved down to the younger generation. Coming now from green, green states and green, green places to the brown clarity but austerity of the Southwest Desert, all of a sudden water has another dimension to it. So I guess I scratched my bump of curiosity about doing what I do, which is interpreting my experience of the world in terms of music.
This is Trevor Harris. I've been speaking with American composer Judith Zamont. She'll be in town this weekend for the Saturday premiere of her new work, The River. Kirk Trevor leads the Missouri Symphony Orchestra this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Missouri Theater. Here's a selection from Zamont's parallel play for saxophone quartet. For Darren Helwidge, this is Trevor Harris. Thanks for listening to Thinking Out Loud on 91.3 FM, KBIA. Thank you.